This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Lately, when I've tried to imagine the future, I just imagine everything on fire. My cat's on fire, the kitchen's on fire, I wake up in the morning and my bed's on fire, I get up and put on my socks, which are on fire, I have a shower and the soap's on fire, I get out again and my towel's on fire, I go to work, my street's on fire, I wave to my neighbour who's on fire, the cars are driving past, they're on fire, everything's on fire, and it's very uncomfortable, but we've just learned to get on with it, you know? Even all the fish underwater are on fire. Maybe I'll go to the doctor and he'll be on fire and he'll say, well, yes, that does look like a broken leg. And look, I know you know this already, but as a doctor, I have to tell you that you're on fire. And given enough time, it's actually a risk factor for burning to death. And I'll say, I know, doctor, but just with work and everything, I've just been so busy to do anything about it. And he'll say, well, fair enough, in front of a poster that says, thinking about quitting, being on fire? Ask your doctor about fire replacement tiger balm nipple patches today. And I'll be late to work and my boss will say, this is unacceptable. And I will say, I'm sorry, I was on fire. And he'll say, well, Sally here is also on fire and she met it on time. So literally being on fire isn't an excuse to turn up late. And I wish I could set my boss on fire, but he's already on fire. And that's what I imagine when I imagine the future. I see and hear it a lot, this idea that humans are bad at long-term thinking, that we're not good at planning, that it's really hard for people to think beyond their most immediate problems. I've heard that people don't really think about the future until they have children, that people seek immediate gratification and that people will always prioritize short-term profit over long-term gains. I find it's an idea that pops up everywhere, especially in a doomer context where the subtext is, well, I can't do anything because it's just impossible for humans to act towards the future. Now, as someone who has very little sense of internal time and is always late for things and surprised by my friends' birthdays, I really have some sympathy for the idea that the future is a slippery concept to grasp. But there's just so much wrong about this idea that humans are bad at planning for the future. Like in June this year, the Sagrada Familia, a cathedral in Spain, it finished construction after 140 years of being built. Some cathedrals took 500 years to build. Like lots of infrastructure has been started in one generation and finished in another. Like even on an individual level, like people save for their own retirement. Yesterday, I planted a seedling that I will never see grow into a fully formed tree. This week, I also learned about hunger stones, where in times of extreme drought, people in Europe placed like special stones at the bottom of dried up riverbeds as a message to the future, future people facing the same situation. Like some of these stones are like hundreds of years old. Like some of them have the date on them. Some of them are carved with warnings. If you think it's just politicians that have no long-term thinking, like just look at defense spending. Like people can and do plan for the future all the time. But like how and what we imagine, it doesn't just spring out of thin air. Like politicians aren't spending all their money on submarines just because the idea randomly popped into their heads one day. Our imaginations, they can be hijacked, massaged, directed, inspired, and even liberated. Other people's ideas about the future like influence our ideas about the future, and our ideas influence them. I don't think that the future that I imagine is a very good one, and I don't want it to happen, but it has been informed by reading the news and that comic about the dog saying this is fine. It sounds really basic to say, but we have to imagine a future before we fight for a future, and we need to fight for a better future. So what kind of futures can we imagine? In this episode, I'm going to be talking with some authors of novels that are set in the future, as well as fans of media set in the future and what they like about it. So firstly, let's start with some book recommendations.
I've been loving Jeff Vandermeer's novels lately, especially Born. It's set in a post-apocalyptic future where, wouldn't you know it, humans have ruined the world. What makes the setting interesting to me is that the city in which the book is set is ruled over by non-human life. Much of it originally created by humans for some unknown purpose, but it has since broken free of human control and left to survive and discover its own way of life. It acknowledges that ecologies will never be the same after humans, but life will go on in some strange new form.
When I think of the stories of the future that I like the most and would wish to believe in the most, and therefore I guess find the most interesting, it's probably Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time. So the book is set in two time periods. It was written in, published in 1976, and so it's set in 1970s New York, Spanish Harlem particularly. And the main character, Consuela, Connie, time travels between then and her experiences as a poor woman of colour, and into a utopian future where her experience of being a woman of colour is dramatically different. And it's a great read. I've actually only read the novel once. I've sort of dipped in and out a couple of times, but there's elements of it that are, you know, quite upsetting, particularly the parts set in the contemporary world in the US. But the utopian future that Marge Piercy envisions is so sweet, but also she's really thought about the spectrum of human needs. And so she's not only thought about, you know, the boring fundamentals of the division of labor and responsibility and duty and community building, and, you know, how things like child rearing and labor specialization are dealt with, but she's also thought about things like pleasure, personal fulfillment and exploration, frivolity, fun, games, novelty, and how you can have sort of endless variety and still have closed loop systems where there isn't waste. And, you know, so there's a bit of wish fulfilling technology there, but they're basically things that are reasonably achievable, like industrial printers that use organic materials as the base of the manufacture, and I don't think we're really that far off at all of that kind of, you know, there's already plastics made out of potato starch. You know, there's a scene where there's a ball and everybody's making these fancy dresses and outfits. And at the end of the night, you know, they all get composted again because they've served their purpose and they've lived the night, and then they can go back, and then they could be recreated at any time. You know, they could use that pattern again, but there's a recognition of the transience and the joy of moments in that scene of the novel that I just think about it all the time.
Hi. I want to talk about the novel Salvage by Australian author Jennifer Mills. It's a apocalyptic climate novel set in a future where unfortunately the trajectory that we're on comes to pass, and we have stuff the climate and deeply hurt nature's capacity to look after humans on this planet. It's a great novel, though. It's a lots of things I really like about it. But one of the things I like about the future that Jennifer Mills creates is that the rich people, the people who have got us into the climate mess, the people that have been responsible for the destruction of nature and harming people through that process, you know, they don't get away with it. They can't escape the consequences of their actions. And they try. They try to go to space. They think that they can live on ships cruising the oceans, and they try to hide out in their bunkers on remote islands. But they can't escape. They can't escape the consequences of the climate catastrophe they have wrought. But who does survive better than the climate catastrophe? The people that create connection with each other and demonstrate care and love. And that's the kind of future. With that, we can have a much better future.
Look, maybe it's not my favourite of all time, but a future that I keep thinking about is Star Trek. And what I love is that they've abolished money and everyone's vegan. And in TNG, at least, there's this ethic that we're here to help and observe and not to dominate. Competition and domination are kind of seen as backwards, like born out of scarcity and small-mindedness. It's not a perfect world. It's not a perfect future. Starfleet is a military organization. It's extremely hierarchical, and I would prefer it if the starships were more democratic and the crew voted on decisions collectively rather than leaving everything up to Jean-Luc Picard all the time. And look, a lot of problems are solved in Star Trek because they were given like magic, create something out of nothing machines. But I think the biggest thing that I enjoy about Star Trek is the cool aliens, and also like the transformation of society from one that prioritizes economic growth to one where the highest priority is self-actualization. But let's talk about another world set in space, where humans have also invented a lot of magic technology, but this societal shift hasn't taken place. The world of Warhammer.
Warhammer envisions a future
40,000 years from now.
Tell me about this future.
Oh, it's pretty bad. It's a future where most civilizations, I guess, exist just to feed like a galactic-wide war effort. There's basically only war.
Is the Earth the part of this war?
The Earth is, like most science fiction, far future things, Earth is like the center hub of humanity as we've reached the stars. And so Earth is where the big galactic emperor of mankind is residing.
And what's the world like? Is it beautiful?
It's beautiful because of lots of cool architecture. I don't think the planet Earth in 41st millennium has any plants or wildlife left, but it has a lot of future Gothic architecture. And that's kind of like a recurring theme of like different planets that have been terraformed or inhabited, and they eventually get put to purpose. So, you know, so there might be a world and they turn it into an agricultural world that is just made for farms to feed all these other parts of this massive empire of mankind, and another world that they just make bullets. And another world where they mine and melt metal to make cutlery. But it means, yeah, so like there's a lot of places in the universe that may have had environment, but a lot of them are purpose fit for like a big industrial war effort.
And is this an extension of today's logic, or is it inspired by something?
So Warhammer, the stories and the characters, they were originally back in the late 70s and 80s, were very just fun, fictional, so it wasn't serious. And then as it, I think the hobby side and the company and the sale of miniatures gained momentum, they started filling in the gaps of these silly little characters they'd made, and then giving them stories and some nuance and parody and comedy in there. But I think when people get into a hobby, they start to take it very seriously when they think of the stories and the backstories, and they're spending a lot of money on an army or a product. So I think inherently the fans take it more seriously than the creators and story writers did. It grew from a place that wasn't such a serious doom and gloom narrative. It was very just like, here's a spaceman and here's a mutant one kind of thing. That's fun.
Is there much world building or lore about the environment, or is it really a backdrop for the adventures of the mutant spaceman?
It's mostly a backdrop. However, in some of the like novels and stories, and the environment plays a bigger role. So, for example, there's still planets out there. Like, there's still planets that are maybe like untamed or untouched by like the Imperium of Man. And so some of them are called death worlds. And so they're just massive jungle worlds or worlds where the environment is so harsh, it's really difficult to colonize.
Seems like there's a lot of boundaries and borders in this world. Like there's a nature world, but it's all nature. And then there's
Yeah,
cutlery world,
yeah.
it's all cutlery. Or there's
Yeah.
bullet factory world, all bullet factories. So
Definitely, yeah.
there's not
Yeah.
like somewhere where people live in harmony with the bullet factories and the cutlery factories and a tree. It's just like everything is extreme. Can you tell me about the process in which Earth got to a planet-sized city? What happens between now and 40,000 years in the future to make Earth this way?
There are mention of like planets that they've inhabited and colonized, and then on a long enough timeline, they build cities. Those cities become mega cities. Those mega cities get so big that they kind of pierce the stratosphere, as we know, as with cities and with population growth, they just keep spreading outwards. And so when you've got like 40,000 years into the future, if someone inhabits a moon nearby and they put a city there, like 40,000 years in the future, it's like these just cities have expanded to be planet wide.
Their GDP must be incredible. Are there peace activists in Warhammer?
Not really in humankind. So the main factions are generally just humanity, which all worship the emperor of mankind, and they have their like differing factions and their superhuman soldiers, etc. And then in the narrative there is like evil gods, and so the humans that turn to the evil gods because current society and bureaucracy has failed them, so they kind of go to the their vote for that guy even though he's really bad, just because we want something different. And then the rest are aliens. There's one alien faction that kind of on the surface level seem to be about peace and unity, but there's a little bit of shady, maybe possibly mind control going on, to subdue their citizens to be complacent. So it's not a really nice place to be. And even the kind of peace activist ones are kind of manipulative.
And what appeals to you about this future? Why is this your favorite vision of the future for humanity?
I think because there is the general narrative is that in the bigger picture, there is not the one good guy, even though kind of fighting for mankind, mankind causes a lot of pain and suffering just to be the dominant faction in the galaxy. So even though everything's terrible, you get these little stories about individual characters, this one soldier and his troop and things, they go together to try and complete something for the greater good. Even though in a wider sense, maybe that greater good would be a bit toxic. The appeal is when you're painting like little miniatures that each one is like a little character and unique, could have its own story, especially when you're rolling dice and just a very tiny little weak human being fighting scary mutants may just roll really well, and suddenly you're rooting for that little underdog miniature to kind of win the board game. And so it's about those little stories.
Okay, so it's a horrible future for humanity, but because things are so dark and bleak, this offers like a particularly dramatic backdrop for a hero to come through. Is that the appeal of this future for you?
Yeah, definitely. Heroes and villains. You get some very interesting, some nasty, nasty characters. But the key word is interesting. So there's some of the books are just about a really horrible character or a horrible person being horrible to other people, but in a very clever, unique way, or a very entertaining way.
That's about
So
the drama.
sometimes, yes, I think it's about the drama, but there is those. I think that it always is the fun part of, if you're playing a faction that is pretty well known for doing horrific things to people, then, you know, you get to embrace and be like the, you know, the villain character of like, I'm bringing my bad guys in, and we're going to be bad. We're going to be the evil guys, and, you know, kind of fun aspect of that. And then being someone fighting them, you have that righteous stance of, oh, we got to stop the bad guys.
Mm.
And so when it's two bad guys going against each other, it's fun for both people playing those those stories.
Mm-hmm. My guy is the baddest bad guy. No, my
My guy's badder than yours. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I guess what sets different aside is the race of aliens called the Tyranids.
Mm.
And they're like a hive mind of kind of insectoid creatures that they grow them to fit for purpose, to what purpose they need for battles. And they just consume. So there is no malice behind it. They're just there to keep going and get bigger. And they just consume like biological matter. So on one hand, you've got worlds that are getting, you know, stripped of all the nature and environments to build factories.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other hand, you've got these aliens that are just eating entire worlds and jungles and biomes just to get bigger. So interesting part of that is just, you know, the fact that they're not good or bad. They're just a kind of an invasive species that just want to exist.
So now we've gone through the story a bit. What is Warhammer? It's a game, right? So what do you actually do?
So it's essentially, the way I think of it is, it's like playing chess. But if you got maybe six chessboards together and then, you know, put all the pawns in one pile and make that a unit, and then put the knights and the rooks and everything, and then added like shooting to that. So you've got these miniatures, just like the, you know, the pawns and the castles and chess that have certain rules of the way they move, or in this case, the way how they attack. And then you just basically versus another player. Sometimes you have objectives that you have to do, so it just brings more strategy into that kind of board game. But a big part of it, why it appeals to people, even though it's about these horrible wars and these horrible futures, is that that you get to paint and put together, and that's the time it takes to build an army. By cutting out the little bits of plastic, gluing them together, and then painting them. But that takes up most of the hobby. So unlike, it's not just fighting someone on the tabletop is not the whole part of it. A huge part is that creative part of coming up with the story about your little guys and where they fit in into that horrible, horrible future. And then how you paint them. And, you know, like any hobby, it's like about the skill and kind of, you know, improving on your own abilities to paint. And
you actually get little toys, little dollmen.
Like chess, in here you got the chess pieces. Imagine there were little tiny little plastic guys that are detailed. So the alien ones are little tiny, these crab insect looking aliens, and you get to paint them, and you can paint them any color you want. And I think that's the fun aspect of it.
From space, we've traveled to Tasmania, the end of the world in some ways. In Romy Ash's new speculative fiction novel, Mantle, the world is getting hot. The world is getting weird. The world is dying, or is it just transforming into something new? We follow Ursula, a geologist, an expert in the Earth's late history, as she travels to Tasmania to look after her mother, who has a mysterious illness. But she soon finds that the future might not be as easy to define as the past. Look, I'm trying to describe this book to you, but the plot isn't really important. It's funny, it's absurd, it's kind of gory, it's evocative, it's thoughtful. Romy was nominated for the Miles Franklin for her last book, Floundering, and I wouldn't be surprised to see this one up there too. I sat down to talk with Romy about her writing process.
My name is Romy Ash, and I'm a writer of novels, essays, short stories. I've got a kid's book out,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, I also teach writing at Uni Melbourne.
Mm. Your new book is set in a future where climate change is really starting to bite.
It is, it is. And I had a 12-year-old at one of my book launches in Hobart in Nipaluna. And she put her hand up and she was like, when is this book set?
Mm.
And I was like, tomorrow. And she was like, ah, scared.
So that sets the scene for how this book is going to go. How did you come up with this particular climate future? Did you do research? Did you just extrapolate from today's?
Oh, I did a whole heap of research on many different things. Mm. I think it's been talked about enough in the media for us to be able to talk about it, but it has, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, just a tiny spoiler. Mm. It has a kind of mycelial fungal mushroom element. Mm-hmm. And I was just doing some reading about, forest ecology and also like human bodies and how we're at this point in time. We're at this perfect temperature where, we're not kind of getting overtaken by fungal infections. Mm. Our bodies are kind of just that right temperature where we're okay. Mm-hmm. But there is a sort of school of thought around if things get hotter, if the temperature of the world gets a little bit hotter and we're sort of part of that, mm. That our bodies will start behaving differently in relation to fungi. Mm. I kind of just took that idea and went with it. And over sort of the different time periods, there has been sort of eras that are more sort of fungi focused. So there's a theory around after the comet or whatever it was that sort of killed off the dinosaurs, mm. there was this sort of darker period of time where the fungi thrived on, the bodies of all the dead creatures and that sort of thing.
I've never really thought of that, actually. After the great dying, there would have been a great decaying as well.
A great decaying, yeah. It's so fun to just think about, that we're all compost or about to be compost, and the world is made up of this sort of, moving through of nutrients through sort of different stages.
Yeah, kind of. Compost machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so when you imagine a climate future, it's like you latched onto this, one particular thing that's a possibility of happening and then explored all the different ramifications of that one possibility.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking a lot about, when I'm writing, it's sort of a way of thinking for me. Mm. So I was just really sad, I guess, at this when I was started writing this book. I had the death of someone close to me, so I was grieving. I had this big personal grief.
Right.
And then I was grappling with all this climate grief and anxiety, especially post 2020 Black Summer and the floods up in the Northern Rivers, which is where I'm from. And, all the different and continuing versions of these horrors, I just wanted to explore those feelings, and writing fiction is just a great fun way to do that. Mm. I think I feel better after writing it.
You're like, I'm sad, let's stay here for years.
Yeah, for years. Yeah,
really think about it
now. Just spend a year talking about yours. I'll spend a year talking about how sad I was. And I'm just laughing now. I think I've talked about it enough, but yeah, it's such a privilege to have the book out there being read and talked about.
So landscapes and nature are a big part of your previous book as well before this. Do you see it as context for your characters, or a foundation for your characters, or a metaphor for their inner lives, or just another character in the story?
Yeah, I think in Mantle, Mantle's all about dissolving barriers between things or boundaries. So in a lot of ways, the characters of Mantle become part of the landscape and the landscape becomes part of them. Mm-hmm. And I think isn't just in this speculative world, but it's kind of an acknowledgement of how the world is now as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these sort of barriers or boundaries that we put between things, mm-hmm. We create them, they don't actually exist. So if you think about, I was sort of thinking about, bodies as a sort of habitat, There's this really cool mite that lives on your face, which is like a Dermodex mite, and we all have them. And they sort of know our routine, you know, like they know when we're sleeping. They come out of our skin when we're still, you know, and like those creatures just live with us all the time. So it was thinking about this book, it's more like, oh, well, perhaps my skin is a habitat too. Perhaps my skin is a landscape. But of course, Lutruwita Tasmania is just bloody stunning. And, you know, that all that environment is just alive there in the book in all its specificity. And Floundering was set in WA. It's, set on that gorgeous coast, which has where kind of like the desert meets this beautiful turquoise sea. Yeah, I just get a feeling sometimes when I'm out in certain places that there's a story there and I might want to write it.
Yeah, so if people are a habitat, if we're our own landscapes, but we're in this greater context of climate change, if the climate is changing, then we also have to change.
Yeah, we've got to change. And yeah, the change might be something we haven't expected. It might be scary. But you know, our bodies change all the time. Ursula, who's the main character of my book, she's sort of perimenopausal, and I don't know, like there's, you could have a think about this book as, sort of this crazy, terrifying embodiment of, like a perimenopausal change. You know, she's hot and hungry and horny, and her body's doing stuff that she can't control and, doesn't expect.
Well, you mentioned scary things. How does writing about climate change futures make you feel? Like, while you're writing it, do you feel like interested and knowledgeable, like you're a science communicator through the power of fiction, or do you feel like trepidation?
Yeah, well, I did read a lot of science. I read a lot of geology books, and I read a lot about sort of seaweed propagation. There's all these different strands to the book. And I mean, I find the stuff around seaweed propagation really heartening, you know, just the sort of work that kind of local people are doing in their areas, sort of rebuilding seaweed forests and reefs and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think what really surprised me about this book is that it ended up being a very funny book. And I don't really think of myself as a funny person or anybody, and someone who writes comedy, that's not me. And I wouldn't say it's comedic, but Ursula, the main character, sort of when she came into herself on the page, she's just funny. And I think there's something about that lightness or that ability to see the absurd and kind of move forward with it that is also kind of quite heartening. I don't think this is a depressing book, and I don't think it's dystopian. I don't actually want to read dystopian climate fiction. I'm just not kind of interested in it. I think that there's a path forward that involves radical change, and that radical change is scary, but it's a different sort of frightening to, you know, a dystopian horror where people are doing horrible things and, you know, just killing one another.
Yeah, I was happy to hear you say absurd, because it does seem like we find ourselves in a very absurd situation where bizarre things are happening all the time.
Yes, yeah. I just that's why I think speculative fiction is just so great for this moment, because, you know, this moment is ridiculous. I can't, you know, like I'm scrolling the internet, and I've just been really looking up fancy chickens lately.
Oh, nice.
And then I'm just like, is this a real fancy chicken? Like, I can't tell. Like, the fancy chickens are so absurd, and it's like, is this an AI absurdity, or is this a real life thing, you know? And our sense of reality is being unsettled in this really strange way. And yeah, I so often am kind of just shocked about what's happening and where we are. And yeah, I just think we have to speak to it with humor, with, with the absurd, because how real life is so strange now. Mm. It's like, how do you write realism anymore? I don't know if you can. Mm. Instead, yeah, I just think it, speculative fiction is just suits what's happening now.
Mm. So when people want to expand their imaginations about the climate future, if they find themselves imagining one particular sort of future, but then they think to themselves, you know what, maybe even weirder things are possible, would you recommend doing the kind of research that you did, like looking into the kelp experiments? Or would you recommend like extrapolating from a weird weather day that they've already experienced or something else?
Yeah, I think maybe a confluence of many things. Yeah, so I think fiction is a coming together of many things. Mm. I would just suggest that other writers out there who want to experiment in this realm is to just follow your own obsession. So I've just been obsessed with forest ecology and fungi for years, you know, like a decade. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one of my obsessions. I've, the last 5 years or so, I've been doing a lot of cold water swimming and snorkeling down in Tassie. Mm. And just like really interested in seaweeds and what the seaweeds used to be like, what's there now. Mm. So just the coming together of all of that. So bring your own obsessions to the project. Mm. And then I always think that fiction comes from a weird feeling as well. So that weird feeling, like something you can't explain easily and you might just want to spend a bit of time with on the page.
Tell us about the events that you have coming up.
Well, I'm doing this Yarra Libraries workshop.
Mm-hmm. About imagining climate futures for emerging writers, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think I don't think you have to be emerging for that. I am doing a speculate workshop with the Emerging Writers Festival that's mm-hmm. coming up. I'll be at the Byron Writers Festival if anyone's up there. And also the Headland Writers Festival. That's in Tathra in New South Wales.
I could have talked to Romy all day, but next we're on to Killionaires, a novel that's exactly what it sounds like, a fun, lighthearted romp about bringing billionaires to justice. I spoke with the author, Scott Licky, over the phone just as he was recovering from the flu.
Hey, everybody. I'm Scott Licky. I'm an author and an international human rights lawyer and a political activist and somebody who believed as strongly as ever in the idea of world citizenship and the potential that that offers all of us to the future that we deserve and not the future that we're looking probably to get.
Just your basic sort of everyday sort of normal sort of guy.
You bet.
Now, you've taken a bit of a detour from your very serious, useful work in human rights lawyering, and you've written a new novel of fiction, Killionaires. It's set in a future where climate change is really starting to bite. How did you come up with this climate future?
Well, you know, first of all, just to say what a pleasure it is to be on your show, and also what a pleasure it is to finally branch out into the world of fiction. Mm. You know, I've been writing books and UN reports and things like that for decades now. And the breath of fresh air you get when you suddenly switch from nonfiction to fiction is one of the great liberating experiences of life, because you can let your mind go into directions where, you know, you just wherever it happens to take you. And no footnotes, most importantly. Not a single damn footnote in this whole book. So that's really great. And I, you know, after having fought battle after battle and country after country and, you know, definitely winning some, I decided, you know, at a certain point, you know, later in life, shall we say, to try to pursue similar objectives, but through the vehicle of fiction rather than actual hardcore on the ground activism. So this direction of writing my first novel, Killionaire.
Does this mean that fiction is a place where there's no such thing as winning and losing? Or does it mean that this is more like a power fantasy for you, where you can actually see the results that you've been working towards?
Total power fantasy. Yeah, in a way it is a power fantasy for sure, because every human rights person or people who happen to believe in basic human rights and things like that in the world, we all have a vision of the world that we would like to see. And, you know, people can relatively easily articulate that. You know, I want to see a world where people are not murdered. I want to see a people where there's more fairness and more income equality, etc. And I thought, let's try to do that with regard to stumbling blocks to the better future that we all deserve. And the first one I chose was the growing income inequality phenomenon of billionaireism. And then what would that actually look like in the real world were we to, as a species, tackle this phenomenon in a way that bring about a future where there was much more equality than there is today, and where maybe even the whole phenomenon of billionaireism no longer existed. And I should also say that there are thousands and thousands of books and academic reports and journalistic pieces and films all about the dangers of growing income inequality. But those are only going to be read and viewed by a very tiny portion of the human race. And you know, another reason I'm starting to go down this novel line, and I'm already working on novel number three now, is to attract people that won't read all that academic stuff, or, you know, boring 500-page treatises on different economic theories. I wanted to write something that would attract ordinary people who want to have a little bit of fun along the way with an imaginary world, but that's very much grounded in the reality of the world today.
So how does writing about climate futures make you feel? What's happening while you're writing?
Well, I mean, to be perfectly honest, most of the time what happens when I'm writing is I'm just laughing my head off. I wake up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as imaginable at exactly 4 a.m., start writing from basically 4 in the morning till 8 in the morning. And when it's happening almost in an effortless manner. And I have to stop, not because the ideas stop, but because my fingers hurt, basically. And then I kind of think about it for the next 20 hours, both awake and sleeping, and then I'm ready to go the next day, and I just keep going that way. And I basically try to envisage what I believe the human race's future should be, and one that is premised on foundations such as equality, fairness, absolute end to poverty and deprivation, absolute end to human rights violations, absolute security for the environment, and ultimately, obviously, tackling climate change.
Well, I think that when you're spending those 20 hours thinking about the concept of fairness, you're not thinking about like the abstract idea of fairness. Are you thinking about how it happens between people in your fictional world?
Yeah, very much. And, you know, I think one of the themes I deal with and grapple with, some of the characters in these books of mine have to deal with the fact that acting in a pure and moralistic manner will never get them to the point that they want to reach. So they have to kind of start breaking rules, and they have to kind of start fudging things a little bit, and maybe even doing some pretty bad things in order to achieve something bigger. And, you know, it's similar to what's happening in the real world, where protest rights are being slowly taken away from people. Protesting against certain things will and can result in arrest. And so that's just one modern manifestation of that whole issue of how do we actually get somewhere in a world where the system is set up to protect those who are completely and utterly dominant and in control, and where law is not used as a force of liberation and freedom and equality, be it one of oppression and maintaining a status quo that is ultimately totally destructive to society as a whole. So that constant confrontation of should I do this or should I not do this is a very big part of what goes on in the minds of the protagonists, the good guys in Killionaire. Can we really do this, you know, in the interest of a better future? Or should we pursue some other strategy or tactic to tackle the idea of billionaireism?
So when you want to explore a concept, you set it up as a dilemma for the characters to work through.
Well, to a degree, yeah, that's true. And then also just putting forward to the reader, for instance, indirectly, what would you do if you were in this situation? You know, would you just sit back and take it, you know? And that can apply to the real world right now. Should we just sit back and take this vision of artificial intelligence that's being foisted upon everybody? Do we really want to have this machine, essentially, control increasing numbers of things across society in the years to come. I just read recently about this study of where students, I think it was at Stanford, were asked, how many of you would have fought actively against slavery if you happened to live during that time? Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's hand goes up, right? But in the real world, how many people really did fight against slavery at the time that it was happening? It was a tiny, tiny proportion, you know? And I think that is true today as well with the big issues that affect all of us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a tiny proportion of people, all of whom will be affected. But there's a tiny number that are actually willing to stand up for the principle, you know, putting themselves out there and saying, I disagree with this. I dissent. You know, I don't want this future. And that's, you know, another one of my big motivators for pursuing fiction rather than just doing the ordinary nonfiction human rights work that I always do. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we get further into the broader public mind that these ideas that we are being confronted with, over which we have no control, but we are all negatively affected by them. How do we get more people, you know, engaged with these types of things? And that's for sure a motivation behind writing these novels. And also, it's just a very fun thing to do. It's a very fun scenario to sit with a blank page and imagine a story, you know, and you know, life is basically stories, and coming up with new ones is, you know, one of the funnest things one can do in life.
Do you see some of the problems in the world as a failure of imagination to be able to envisage this possible future that we could build together?
That's a really good question, and I think that's really true. You know, for instance, you know, one of the other big issues I work on is world citizenship, you know, and, you know, the idea that all of us humans, 8.2 billion of us, who are all essentially the same, should have the same passport, the same nationality, the same rights, the same responsibilities, all grouped together in a single political entity in which all of us participate as equals. And, you know, the amount of people that, and this is an idea, an ancient idea that's been around for thousands of years, the amount of people that say, you know, you're just a dreamer, mm-hmm. you know, you're being so unrealistic, that's just some esoteric pipe dream, it's never going to happen. You know, and I still don't buy that. I still totally believe very firmly, despite all the reasons not to, that we can achieve that objective, but we have to find our way there. I hope that my novels will help people to see that such visions are much more possible than most people think. I want to basically see it as just within our grasp, you know, and it's only a few things that are holding us back. You know, again, it's within our grasp. We are almost there. We're millimeters away. We just have to make tiny steps and we can actually achieve it. It's a much more realistic scenario than most people realize. There's a lot of, you know, the zeitgeist of the times right now and the kind of very frequently uttered sentiment is that everything's collapsing, mm-hmm. everything's dying, the whole system is dismantling, mm-hmm. we're doomed, etc., etc., etc. And yes, there's a plethora of problems we can point our eyes at and see very clearly, but there's also, you know, the possibility that in viewing those problems we become motivated to unify in a manner that we never have done before. And that's what I hope. And also, when you see sentiments in society, even here in wonderful Australia, and much more so in other parts of the world, where, you know, a boogeyman character is created in the form of a migrant or an immigrant mm-hmm. or a non-white person or whatever it may be, and that's going to somehow solve society's problems. I mean, it's just unbelievable that people would even fall for that. But sometimes when those horrible things occur, that is enough to stir reasonable people into a direction like, hey, wait a minute here. We're all humans, for goodness sakes, you know? I'm not going to fall for that. So hopefully these novels will, you know, provoke people to see the brighter side of the human condition and remember what is possible. And we have achieved so much as the human race over the centuries, millennia, but there's still so much more to go.
And I think, you know, on an optimistic note, I really think we've barely scratched the surface of what our planet could be. And you know, that's the type of sentiment I'm trying to get out there in the world, and which is so consumed now with demise and destruction and doom, that we can actually transcend that and become, you know, the species that we were ultimately destined to become, which is one that, you know, accepts the fact that we're alone in the universe. We have one planet to work with. We have one species of human. And the sooner that we unify and understand that, the quicker we can make decisions that lead to prosperity for everyone, everywhere, all the time. And again, it might seem like a pipe dream, but just look at what we've achieved and imagine what we could achieve if we all put our minds together and focused on these shared attributes of what it means to be human instead of accentuating the differences, which has been for a very long time the basis upon which we've decided to govern ourselves.
There's a few things that you've touched on that I really want to get into a bit deeper. Do you think that this narrative of doom and decay and destruction is limiting or shaping our imaginations of the future? And you've also talked about utopianism and pipe dreams as kind of being seen as like silly or childish. Do you think this is a narrative that also limits people's imaginations about what they think could be possible?
Yeah, to a degree. So, you know, even the word itself, utopian, you know, has a negative connotation now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, you're living in a utopia. That sounds good. No, it's more like, don't be so utopian. That's so unrealistic, you know, because the original definition of utopia is no place, right? So it's the place that cannot exist. And, you know, I think if you look at the world today, and, you know, if you've traveled as much as I have, you can find these places everywhere. There are existing utopian realities all across the world this very second in terms of the way I would see a definition of utopia, you know, which is the air is sort of clean. The water is sort of clean. You know, food is abundant. People are kind. Music is playing. Mm-hmm. You know, the vibes are good. The trees are green, et cetera, et cetera. You know, basic things, not some futuristic society that is an impossible dream. So we're not actually that far from being able to create those types of realities at a larger scale. But we need to get to the point where enough of us do not accept the contemporary reality that we're willing to put forward visions that ultimately are attainable and doable. And I believe on almost every single major challenge that confronts humanity at the macro level, whether it's air pollution or climate change or land degradation or the acidification of oceans, there are very clear identifiable solutions for all of these. And that's the point we have to reach. We can't throw in the towel. We can't just accept that the collapse is coming and everything's going to be horrible. We can't just rely on hope, obviously, but it will take action, you know, and it takes actions to build the future that we want to see. But it's always so much easier to play the fear card than play the bright future card. And you see the fear card being played constantly now. Fear of the other, fear of the future, fear of everything. And when people are fearful and they allow fear to guide their political decision-making, you very often get scenarios which only facilitate the future they're trying to avoid. So, I mean, any embrace of fascism or extreme right-wing ideologies, people, you know, they refuse to look back at history, and history shows very convincingly that those types of attempts at building a new society grounded on fear of the other, et cetera, or terror of the other, always end in failure, always end in absolute tragedy. And that's the sad thing to see, that people still fall so quickly for cheerful antics rather than ones that are, you know, more advanced and evolved ways of thinking. And, you know, there's a reason why very rich people are very rich, you know, like going back to Killionaire. And very often the time is, the reason is there's no inbuilt satiation device. You know, they're like golden retrievers. They never feel full. They never feel like they have enough. And they have to constantly acquire more. And that process of increased accumulation and never being satisfied, what leads to this ultimate destination of very high concentrations of income inequality, for instance, which is now, you know, translated directly into political power. Mm. And that's another thing that I'm trying to get across with these novels, is we got to start reconsidering very basic questions like, why should a rich person even be allowed to become a politician? I think it's very easy to come up with a very convincing argument that either you choose wealth or you choose politics. You do not and cannot choose both. And there should be, for instance, there's a pretty interesting debate whether we should have a cutoff level of wealth accumulation. Mm-hmm. You know, should there be limits placed on individual wealth? And in the particular context of politics, what if we had limits on not just on political contributions, as in making every bit of politics publicly funded with no private funds involved, but also at the individual politician level? Maybe nobody with a net worth over a certain amount should even be allowed to enter politics and make decisions on behalf of other people, because you know that those same people are never going to make decisions which are contrary to their own economic interests. There's all sorts of issues that can be looked at, again, going back to the novel, in terms of fiction and putting scenarios out there that show that maybe these ideas aren't that outlandish after all. Maybe they're actually a lot more doable than people think.
Now, it sounds like you're a creative person who's brimming with ideas, but for the rest of us, and it comes to the heart of this program, really, how do people come up with these visions? If people want to expand their imagination, what would you recommend? How do you get started in imagining better futures?
Well, I mean, you know, at the one level, it's very understandable that imagining a better future is difficult for somebody who has no savings, somebody who's working, you know, 12-hour days, who has to commute for an hour or two in each direction to get back to a home that they can afford. Being creative and having a daily imagination is kind of a luxury, and I fully and totally understand that. But at the same time, I think everybody has the capacity to imagine, and everybody has the capacity to be creative. And it might be just as you're falling asleep, you know, finally you made it through your day, you're in bed, you're just drifting off, you know. That's very often when I have my most creative thoughts, by the way. You know, I think, again, it really comes down to living the fullest life that you possibly can. Mm. So knowing as many people from as many places as possible, you know, being curious, asking questions, being genuinely interested in people's lives, because they're amazing. I mean, every single life is absolutely amazing when you start asking questions about it, you know. And if you can travel, and if you can learn to cook, and if you can, you know, put your hands in the soil every single day and have your own little garden and grow your own food to the extent that you can, these very, very basic things, you know, that you don't have to become a billionaire in the process. Very often the simplest, smallest things can make such a difference. Just take a second and look at a leaf on a tree, you know, and look at the veins of the leaf of a tree on the back of the leaf, and just marvel at that. And you can do that absolutely for free, absolutely any day, and sort of marvel at the stuff that we totally take for granted and forget to look at.
Of course, I will put all the names and links on the website once this podcast is uploaded, but we'll go through them all again now. So we heard about Born by Jeff Vandermeer. That is Born, B-O-R-N-E. Then we heard about Woman on the Edge of Time. That's a novel by Marge Piercy. After that was Salvage by Jennifer Mills. Warhammer is, you can just Google that. Mantle by Romy Ash. And the last one was Killionaires by Scott Leckie. And thank you for listening to The Climate Action Show. Have a climate action-y day.